Okay, if you'd like to take a seat and grab a Bible that should be behind you and turn to page 883, which is in the Old Testament and is the book of Daniel, beginning of the book of Daniel, chapter 1, 883. Okay, if you're a film buff, then there are all certain things that you know will happen in Hollywood films. Here are just some. For every pair of twins that are born, one is resoundingly evil. If you are a detective, you will never ever solve a crime unless you are suspended first. And then you're usually shot 3 days before retirement. I think that's right. A man will show no pain when taken the most ferocious beating, but will always wince when a beautiful woman tries to clean his wounds. If you decide to start dancing in the street, everyone you bump into will know all the steps. And finally, the more the man and woman seem to hate each other, then the more likely it is that they will fall in love. Okay, what's this got to do with starting a series on the book of Daniel? We're going to be in the book of Daniel between now and Christmas to get to mid-December. And it's this. I suspect that many of us here think we know what the book is all about. We maybe know that Daniel is the most famous vegetarian in Scripture. You probably know that three of his friends ended up in the fiery furnace. And I think especially you'll know that Daniel ended up in the lion's den. Maybe you even know about Belshazzar's feast, where we get the expression "the writing on the wall" is from. There's lots of familiar and great stories in this book. And if you've ever experienced Sunday school as a child, you would have been taught those stories, because they are great to teach children. Now, the challenge for the preaching team over the next couple of months is to try and dig deep to show that there's much more in this book than great stories. And one reason why we've chosen Daniel is because I really believe, it does speak to our context, even though obviously we're separated by many, many years. Now, we do need to do some translation work, but much of what is happening in Daniel is actually very relevant to us this morning. Well, in what ways does it resonate with us? Let me read you a psalm that actually was made famous in the 1970s by a group who were called Boney M. Now, who remembers Boney M? See, we're an aging congregation. You realise that, don't you? Okay. Here, if you knew Boney M and you were around listening to pop music in the 70s, you would be familiar with these words. And I'm not going to sing them. Sorry. Come on. Get it out of your head. It says this: by the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down and wept, there we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. And they said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a strange land? Now, that was written in the time of Daniel by the people of God who had been taken from their own land, Israel, to a very, very strange land, which was Babylon. And that's why in that Psalm 137, it says they hang up their harps, because those harps would have been used in the temple worship. And they put them in the trees, the poplars, and they asked the question, how do we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? They were being tormented. They were saying, oh, sing us some of your songs. And they were saying, how can we do it here? We're in a strange land. We're now among strange things. We're not in Jerusalem. We're not in the temple anymore. Now, I put to you, we may be asking a similar sort of question. Obviously, we can sing, but we may be asking a similar question in another way. And it's this: more and more of our contemporary culture has drifted further and further away from the Christian moorings that were actually once there. I think we now live in a post-Christian society. Lots of cultures and religious beliefs all merged together. And on top of that, we have something called secularism, which is doesn't believe in anything and is increasingly anti-Christian. And unless we lock ourselves away and we become, if you like, maybe a comfortable but a totally ineffective holy huddle, these pressures will come upon us. And I think the challenge for us all is this: how do we stay focused? How do we stay faithful? How do we stay distinctive for Christ in light of the society and culture we're living in? Now, I believe this book does give us some really great answers. I believe Daniel's going to challenge us and encourage us to show us how we can keep our focus upon God, revealed to us in Christ Jesus, while at the same time we live in this strange and hostile environment. What's the main theme of the book of Daniel? What will we be hearing consistently and constantly about over the next 2 months? Well, I have to say this: be prepared to be reminded above all of the sovereignty of God. God is God, he is above all and he reigns over all. The main theme in Daniel is, despite appearances, God is actually still in control. Now, there are many points, I think, in our own lives and experience that I think we need the knowledge of the sovereignty of God to be reasserted. Maybe for you this is one of those times. If so, I think this book will speak powerfully to us on this matter. So at the outset of this series, let's be clear that the main character in the story is not actually Daniel, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or the various kings of Babylon or Persia that come up in the book, but it's actually God. He is bigger in Daniel than the biggest human ruler, and he's more powerful than the most powerful dictator. And in the end, what we learn from this book is the exile in Babylon does not distance God from his people, and they discover that he's there because they know that you can't go anywhere where God cannot be found. Okay, very quickly, what's the historical context of the book? How does it fit in to the Bible? Well, when you read the Old Testament, the state of Israel was at its peak under King David and then under his son, who was called Solomon. But after Solomon died, it split into two. You had the northern kingdom, which was called Israel, and you had the southern kingdom, which was called Judah. In 722 BC, the northern kingdom was overrun by the Assyrians after there had been some dreadful kings and some very courageous godly prophets. The last prophet in the northern kingdom was someone called Hosea. The southern kingdom, which was called Judah, where Jerusalem was the capital, did last another 100 years. And there was in that time one very good godly king who was called Josiah. And he reigned for 30 years. But he had a son called Jehoiakim who was both stupid and wicked. He ignored all the warnings from God's prophets at that time, Jeremiah being the main one. And he introduced idolatry into the temple. He even had one of the prophets who was called Uriah murdered. And the message he received from Jeremiah was this: unless there was repentance, then there would come judgment. And judgment would come in the form of the up-and-coming power of that time, who were the Babylonians. And Jeremiah warned King Jehoiakim that they would actually come and destroy Jerusalem. Now, King Jehoiakim completely ignored this warning. You know why? He said, no, God would always protect his own city. God would never do something like that. And I know it's another sermon, another series, but Jeremiah was treated terribly, terribly persecuted because of this message. But King Jehoiakim was desperately wrong. Let's read the opening two verses of Daniel chapter 1. This is now 605 BC, and it says this: in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put them in the treasure house of his God. So the book of Daniel opens with the prevailing peace in Jerusalem being absolutely shattered by the arrival of this oppressive, powerful, foreign army. And the king of Judah has to surrender to the king of Babylon. And then sacred articles from the temple, thought to be the dwelling place of God, are taken away and they're put instead in the temples in Babylon. In the opening two verses in the book of Daniel, we need to note this, that there's a historical statement, but there's also a really key theological one. In verse 1, we're told Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Jerusalem. That is an undisputed historical fact. But then in verse 2, we're told this, it was the Lord who delivered Jehoiakim into his hands. Now that is a theological statement. You see, on one level, you've just got another Middle Eastern military leader focusing upon a very strategic location, which was Jerusalem, and conquering it in order to add it to his huge empire. But the book of Daniel, right at the beginning, you see, tells us that on a much more deeper level, God was fulfilling statements that he had made through his prophets about what would happen if his words of rebuke and correction and guidance were ignored and treated with contempt, which they had been. And as the city was falling and the temple was being ransacked, I'll tell you this, if you lived in Jerusalem at that time, it seemed as utterly hopeless as it could get. But right there, right at the beginning of this book, in verse 2, we have our main theme, God is sovereign. It's not actually Nebuchadnezzar who's in control in this situation, though it must have seemed like that on that day. What are we told? The Lord delivered Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. The Lord himself, if you like, was involved in the overthrow of his own city and also the exile of his own people. Now, what are those who are taken into exile? Well, let's read verses 3 to 7. Just so you don't get too worried, we're only going to do up to verse 7 today. We're not doing the whole of chapter 1 because there's too much in it. So let's just read 3 to 7 and read about those who were taken from Jerusalem over into Babylon. It says, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Okay, we're told in verse 4 that Nebuchadnezzar had chosen the cream of Judah's young men for a specific reason, and it was this: he wanted them to serve in the king's palace. Now, for those who had been taken, this would have been a traumatic upheaval. All their fixed points had suddenly disappeared as the king sought to assimilate them totally into the life of Babylon. Very quickly, four things had changed overnight for these young men. First one is this. Well done, Josh. I just looked at him and it came up. Their location had changed. They were no longer living in the safe surroundings of Jerusalem that had provided all the structures for their worship and fellowship. They had been taken away from all that represented security, and they were to face this great test as to whether they really believed went to the core of their being, or was it just skin deep and superficial? What would happen to us if all the familiar was taken away? How much do familiar structures sustain and keep us? If they were suddenly swept away, How do you think we would respond? How do you think we would cope? And isn't this true? If just a change of location is enough in itself to silence our tongues and diminish our commitment, then that is an indicator that something is inwardly wrong. Secondly, this, their education has changed. For Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, a program was devised to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. Now, this was much more than an orientation course. Nebuchadnezzar knew that if he could take the cream of Jerusalem and change the way they think, he would also change their convictions and drive them, and the lifestyle, if you like, that marks them. Now, if anyone gets this, I'd be amazed, because it took me nearly a week to find where it was. It says somewhere in the Old Testament, as a man thinks in himself, so he is. Anyone know where that's from? Actually, I don't think it was in the Bible till someone told me. It's actually in Proverbs 23. In the New Testament, we're told this. Paul, the apostle, declares, be transformed. How are we transformed? By the renewing of your mind. Very interestingly, the whole aim of the Babylonians was to take these young men and completely change the way they were thinking. They wanted to create in their minds a worldview that no longer was moulded by the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And interestingly, in every dictatorship that has ever risen in history, exactly the same thing has been attempted: to get hold of the brightest and the best and reprogram their minds, so they will become allies in the cause for a subsequent generation. And the question we were asked at the beginning is this: how would Daniel and his peers withstand this subtle but very powerful pressure? Third thing that changed, their diet had changed. We're told the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. Did you get that? They were to receive the same food that was served to the king. Now, wouldn't you just love that? I know that some of you are foodies out there. Wouldn't you just love every day to get the same food that's from the king's table? What was going on here? Was it that the king was simply just trying to sort of seduce them by offering them, if you like, the good life? And I have to say this, living in the lap of luxury would, I presume, become very seductive. Once we get the taste of the good life, it can easily diminish our zeal. It can change our outlook and priorities, be that very slowly and subtly. Whatever the tactic, it was designed to break them on their annoying conviction that somehow they were different. And one of the ways that they declared their distinctiveness is in what they ate. So if Nebuchadnezzar was going to successfully reprogram their minds and reorientate all their convictions, he would have to break their food habits. And what a better way to do that than offer them food from the king's table? And then finally, their names had changed. The details of this are in verse 7. Now, names in Hebrew culture were very, very important. Whenever you were given a name, it always had meanings. Daniel means God is my judge. Hananiah, the Lord who shows grace. Mishael, the God who is who he is. And Azariah is the Lord who helps us. Now, this was now going to change, and they would be named after the Babylonian gods of Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, I want to say this. If your name is changed, this creates a severe potential for a really deep identity crisis. Did you know this? That cults always give their members new names. Why do they do that? It's a very important part of their programming. Nebuchadnezzar understood that names do matter, so he had them changed. And the aim of all these changes that they had to endure was that it was of subtle coercion. Change their thinking and you'll change their conviction. Are you familiar with the illustration of the frog in a pan of cold water? Don't try this at home. But if you put a frog in cold water and you heat the water gradually, the frog is actually lulled into a false sense of security and just eventually dies as the temperature of the water goes up. But if you were to drop the frog in the water when it was really hot, it would just instinctively leap out. Can we see how this maybe can apply to ourselves? We live in an environment where, so to speak, I think the water is being heated up very slowly. It's not as if we're being asked to bow down to idols. That would be easy to understand and maybe respond to. It's not like we're living under an oppressive government like in North Korea or China, and we're facing outward persecution. But let's be aware of the slow, subtle, degenerative, coercive process that is affecting the way that we think and then the way that we subsequently act. What's been eroded away are the biblical convictions that over time have given strength not only to the people of God, but at one time a moral consensus to the whole nation. That is going in our country now. You could argue it's gone. The great challenge facing Daniel, Hannah, Mishael and Azariah was this: how do they find a way of cooperating without compromising? How do they avoid becoming completely neutralized by being absorbed into everything around them, but also avoid the temptation to withdraw and become this little tribe and have no influence on those around them? And I want to suggest that challenge facing them then in this book is exactly the same one as we're facing now, which is why it's good we're going to be in this book. And I want to say this too. Down through the ages, God's people have always tottered between two extremes. One extreme is this: we just become completely absorbed by the culture of our day, so that we have an audience, but we've got no message to speak because we're actually, in the end, the same as everyone else. Or the other one is to withdraw completely, so that we do have a message to proclaim, but we never have any contact with our contemporaries to tell them what that message is. Now, Daniel, I think, is so relevant because he's a wonderful illustration of someone who was able to interact effectively in a very hostile alien culture while still maintaining the distinctiveness of what it meant to belong to his God. And I think we need to learn from him. We have to live in a postmodern, post-Christian culture where lots of beliefs all merge and pressures for compromise is strong. And let's be honest, it's unrelenting. What should our response be? Well, the night before Jesus went to the cross, which we'll be focusing upon soon, he prayed this prayer about his disciples. It's in John 17, verse 15. But he said this: "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but you protect them from the evil one." Now, can we see that? That clearly is God's will for us. In the fight of faith, we're not to withdraw from the world around us. Daniel and his